Hey, thanks everybody. Good morning, all of you. It's good to see you. We're studying together the book of Ruth in our time here in the Word, and so invite you to turn in your Bibles to Ruth chapter 1. We left off at verse 5 last week, and we're going to pick up at verse 6 and go through the end of chapter 1 here, continuing the narrative and the storyline about a family named Elimelech and his wife Naomi, their two sons Mahlon and Chilion. So where we left off last week, we learned that there was a famine in the land. They were in Bethlehem in Judah, and there was a famine in the Bethlehem means the house of bread, and the house of bread was empty. There was no bread in the house of bread, and so they came up with a plan, and Elimelech moved his family to Moab, a land of their enemies, and the two sons get married to Moabite women, and then the father dies, and then later the two sons die, and Naomi is left without. And that's kind of where we left it. She was without her husband. She's without her sons. And we talked about how what was happening in her life is just really this great emptying. And she uses that word, the filling and the emptying kind of words, to describe her condition. We're going to look at that again today. So we're really, in many ways, you can see God's just emptying her life. And last week we talked about how God does that at times in our life. He takes away things that we would normally want to rely on, like Bethlehem, the house of bread. You would think that would be satisfying. But God takes those things away, not to frustrate us, but to show us that there's only one true source of satisfaction in life, and that's Him. So what's going to happen now, and we'll begin to see this refilling that God's doing after the emptying. There's a refilling that He's going to be doing in Naomi's life. So we're going to pick up the story in Ruth chapter 1, verses 6 through 22. So Naomi is left with just herself and her two daughters-in-laws. And since it's almost Thanksgiving coming up soon, and I know a lot of you will be getting together with family, I thought I would start out a conversation today by asking this question, because I'm sure you know. What's the difference between outlaws and in-laws? Some of you think there is no difference, but there is. The difference between outlaws and in-laws is outlaws are wanted. Well, Ruth is one of the outlaws. Naomi is stuck with her two in-law daughters, her daughters-in-law. So Ruth chapter 1, starting at verse 6, it says, "Then Naomi heard in Moab..." So that's the land of the foreigners, right? She's living in this foreign land for a decade. "She had heard while she's in Moab that the Lord had blessed His people in Judah." Now, when it says His people, it's also her people. She's Jewish. "Naomi heard that in Moab the Lord had blessed His people in Judah by giving them good crops again." So the famine is over, right? "So Naomi and her daughters-in-law got ready to leave Moab to return to her homeland." So what you should see here right away is that the Lord is working, and He had been working through this entire process. But here's evidence of His working by returning the house of bread. He's going to fill the house of bread with bread again. Naomi is empty, but she's going to be going back to a full house of bread. So verse 7 says, "With her two daughters-in-law, she set out from the place where she had been living, and they took the road that would lead them back to Judah." You know, until I was preparing for this morning's message, I didn't put together the fact that they had actually started the journey before Naomi turns and says to her daughters-in-law, "Why don't you guys just stay here?" They had actually been on the road, is what it says in verse 7. They had put the plan together in verse 6. And now they were traveling in verse 7. They're on their way to Judah. Now, keeping in mind, these are Moabite women who are traveling with a Jewish mother-in-law, going back to the mother-in-law's native land, the land of the Jews. But the Moabites are foreigners in Judah. So that's what's going on. Verse 8 says, "But on the way, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go back to your mother's homes. And may the Lord reward you.'" And the word for Lord is Yahweh. "May Yahweh reward you for your kindness to your husbands and to me." The word for kindness here is an interesting Bible word. You may, if you've been around Bible teaching or whatever very long, you may have heard in the New Testament a word for love called agape. It's a unique kind of love. There are several different words in the New Testament for love. There's brotherly love. There's sexual love, an attraction between a husband and a wife. Then there's also agape love, which is a very unique kind of love. Agape love is a completely others-serving love. It's a loyalty kind of love. This word that gets used here in verse 8 is the Old Testament equivalent to that New Testament concept of agape. It's a Hebrew word called hesed. It comes up in a number of places. Probably my favorite place that this comes up is in the book of Hosea. And if you know anything about the story of Hosea, Hosea is a prophet that God says, you need to go and marry a prostitute. If you didn't know that was in the Bible, the book of Hosea is an interesting story. And what God wants to do is he wants to demonstrate his faithful love through the example of Hosea and his relationship with a very unfaithful woman. And he contrasts God's faithful love to Hosea's wife's unfaithfulness. The word that's highlighted throughout that whole book is this same word, God's loving kindness, his steadfast love, his love that isn't going to change. What this word means, it's a loyalty kind of concept. It's hard to even articulate in English what it means. But basically it means this, that no matter what you do, I'm in a relationship with you, and no matter what you do, it will not affect or change how I feel about you. I will love you no matter what you do. That's what Naomi says about her two daughters-in-law here. The kindness, that kind of love, that commitment you've shown to your husbands and to me. May the Lord reward you for showing that kind of love. And it's demonstrated because they packed up their things and they're moving to Judah with their mother-in-law, right? Here Naomi is. She's desperate. She's been emptied. And she urges her daughter-in-laws to go back. Why? Because Naomi has nothing to offer them. Nothing to offer them. So she says in verse 9, may the Lord, again, may Yahweh, bless you with the security of another marriage. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they all broke down and wept. I like the way here in verse 9 that the New Living Translation translates this sentence, because it says, may the Lord bless you with the security of another marriage. Because without another marriage, there wouldn't be security. And I know that sounds sexist from our 21st century mindset, but it just is the reality. A widow in these times without sons and without other extended family to provide for and take care, a widow in those kind of situations was what we would make a comparison maybe in our culture is to a dire homeless person, completely dependent on handouts from other people and the kindness of their heart. So there would be a security that would come. So that was her wish for them. Go back home, and may the God of the Jews bless you with another marriage. And then it says, she kissed them goodbye, and they all broke down and wept. But they don't leave yet. Verse 10 says, no, they said, we want to go with you to your people. But, verse 11, Naomi replied, why should you go on with me? And notice the way she says, this is her reason why. I want you to go back home. Why? Why should you go on with me? Could I still give birth to other sons who could grow up to be your husbands? In other words, I have nothing to offer you. Even if I were to have children now, she's going to make the point. Go back. I have nothing to offer to you. Even if I had sons now who would grow up, would that even be possible for me to give birth to sons who would grow up and become your husbands? In the Old Testament, in Jewish culture, there was this rule called the Levirate marriage. The word Levirate means basically a marriage to an in-law. Right now, some of you just got grossed out. A marriage to an in-law is what that little word Levirate marriage means. Marriage to an in-law. And the rule worked like this. If a man were to die and leave behind a wife without children, that man's brother was required by law, if he were not married, he is required by law to basically take his brother's place and marry his brother's wife and have children for her brother, the first one being born, named after the brother that died. That was Jewish culture and one of the laws that God put into place. And you can read about it in Deuteronomy chapter 25, in Genesis chapter 38, and in the New Testament, Jesus refers to it in Matthew chapter 22. Okay, so she says, is it possible for me to give birth to sons? And then she says in verse 12, no, my daughters, return to your parents' home, for I'm too old to marry again. And even if it were possible and I were to get married tonight and bear sons, then what? Would you wait for them to grow up and refuse to marry someone else? One of the couples from my home church where I grew up, they were dear family friends, and they found out that the husband was 12 years older than the wife. And I remember being in high school when it dawned on me that he was a senior in high school when she was a kindergartner. And I just tried to imagine, like, how you would impress your friends, right? Where you show up to prom alone and your friends would be like, dude, where's your date? And they'd be like, hey, she's still in kindergarten, but wow. So the idea here is, even if I could have boys now, would you wait until they were old enough to get married? That's not going to happen. So again, verse 14. Again, they wept together, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. So one of the daughter-in-laws goes back home. But Ruth clung tightly to Naomi. So one says goodbye. The other one says, no, I'm not going anywhere. And the interesting thing about this is there's this contrast in the story between what Ruth is doing and what Naomi is asking her to do. Naomi is asking her to leave. But Ruth is, instead of leaving, she's clinging tightly. These are interesting words, the word leaving and the word clinging to, because those exact same words come up in the book of Genesis, chapter 2, where God describes marriage for the first time. A man would leave his father and mother and cling to his wife. Naomi's asking Ruth to leave, but instead she clings to, exact same word as in Genesis 2:24. She clings to him in this, it's more than just I'm hanging on to you. There's an actual transaction that's going on here. There's a vow and a commitment that Ruth is making to her mother-in-law. And you'll see that here in just a moment. So here's Naomi, realizing she's emptied and has nothing to offer, and sends her daughters-in-law back. One, Orpah, returns. Ruth says no. And it's more than just I don't think I want to. I'm going to see how this plays out. She's making a vow, a covenant, a promise to her mother-in-law in this whole process. In verse 15, Naomi speaks again. She says, look, Naomi said to her, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. You should do the same. Again, she's trying to convince her to leave. And this is actually the third time that she's brought this up with her daughters-in-law. And third time. Verse 8, verse 12, and now here in verse 15, trying her hardest to encourage Ruth now to leave and go back. But here in verse 15, there's an added detail to the returning that I think is very insightful. Verse 15, look, Naomi said to her, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. You should do the same. And now all of a sudden, the spiritual element gets brought up here in verse 15. This added detail of returning to your gods. What the worldview was back then, and in many ways is a biblical worldview. You remember I've been telling you over the last many weeks about a book I've been reading called The Unseen Realm? Finish the book. Mind-blowing. But one of the broad concepts that comes up in there is the disinherited nations and how they have been assigned Elohim, gods, to rule over them. And there's a parallel story going on in the spiritual realm and on the earthly realm. There's a parallel story going on at exactly the same time. And according to this worldview, and very biblical, different geographical locations have been assigned different gods to rule over them. Those gods have mismanaged the nations. On the surface level, you and I see the disaster that's going on in the human story, but there's a parallel spiritual story that's just as disastrous in the family of God among the spiritual realm. They understood. Everyone had their own territorial gods. If you went to Moab, you followed the god of the Moabites. That's what she's saying. Go back to your people and to the gods who are ruling over that area geographically. Because where I'm going, to Bethlehem and to Judah, is a different geographical region with a different god, the one true God. So she's saying, go back to your people, go back to your gods. Your sister-in-law did it, you should do the same thing. Assuming then, at this point, Ruth had not yet made a commitment to follow Yahweh, the one true God, the God of the Hebrews. But verse 16 clarifies what Ruth's decision is. It's not just a decision to go follow her mother-in-law around. Verse 16 says, but Ruth replied, don't ask me to leave you and to turn back. And then from here to the end of verse 17, I've used this very passage in numerous weddings over the years. And it's appropriate for a wedding passage because that's the kind of a vow that's being made right here by Ruth to Naomi. Ruth replied, don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people. And your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord, and you might notice in your scripture that word is capitalized. It's when you see that, that's the word Yahweh. It's the personal name for Almighty God. May Yahweh punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us. So she's making a vow, a promise, and she's invoking the God of the Hebrews, declaring, that's the God I'm following. That's the God I'm committed to. Not only was Ruth drawn by her loyalty and commitment to Naomi, but clearly she was drawn by a growing desire to know and to follow the one true God, Yahweh. Here in verse 17, she is making a formal oath, committing herself to God, no turning back. And it begs the question, in my mind anyway, what did Ruth see in her mother-in-law Naomi that caused her to be so devoted to her and so devoted to her God? What did she see? What was it about Naomi and her faith that inspired Ruth to want to uproot her life, turn her back on the gods of her childhood, and go live life with Naomi in a foreign land pursuing a God she barely knows? It's unusual. For sure it's unusual. Extraordinary. She not only is demonstrating a loyalty to Naomi, but a major part of her decision is a spiritual one. She's switching from worshiping the gods of her ancestors to following the one true God. And then in verse 18, when Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said nothing more. In other words, she wasn't going to try for a fourth time to send her back home. Ruth had made it clear by clinging to her and by declaring her faith and by making this promise or this vow that she was determined to go with Naomi. And the word with is a special word for me because I'm a with person. I hate being alone. I'm that guy that if I got punished and got sent to my room when I was a kid, it would drive me crazy, right? No, I hate being alone. And here Naomi is, convinced that her life has been emptied out of and has nothing, but yet she has Ruth in a very special relationship. Ruth is determined to go with her. So, verse 19, the two of them continued on their journey. And when they came to Bethlehem, the entire town was excited by their arrival. You remember, Bethlehem's a really small town. It didn't take long for word to spread. And the whole town was excited by their arrival. And their question, is this really Naomi? Everyone asked. They were excited. Is it really her? How long had it been? Well, it had been at least a decade, because we learned in verses 1 through 5 that they had been there 10 years, and then the husband died and then the sons died. So we know at least she was gone for a minimum of 10 years. Is it really Naomi? Could it really be you? In verse 20, Naomi doesn't like her name. And she says, "Don't call me Naomi," she responded. "Instead, call me Mara, for the Almighty has made life very bitter for me." Naomi means pleasant. Pleasant. I thought for an object lesson today, I was going to buy a whole bunch of Hershey's chocolates and hand it out this morning and then say, at this moment, everybody break out your chocolate. Isn't that pleasant? You're just going to have to imagine it. Okay, and then right after that, I was going to give you a spoonful of apple cider vinegar. Boom! Bitter, right? The contrast. Naomi, her name means pleasant. And everybody says, "Ah, could this be pleasant? Welcome back." Yeah, don't call me pleasant. Call me apple cider vinegar. Ugh. Why? Because Almighty God has made life very bitter for me. I went away full, she says in verse 21. I went away full. I had a husband. I had two sons. I went away full. And just time out. Everybody time out, okay? Let's give Naomi a break. She's gone through a lot of trauma, okay? She's gone through trauma. So this isn't bash Naomi for being an idiot, right? That's not what we're here for. But could we just talk about when she left, how full was she really? Because she was starving. And that's why they left. But her experiences are screaming at her a narrative, right? I was full. I had life so good. And then God emptied me, right? God's against me. I went away full, she says, but the Lord has brought me home empty. Is she really empty? She has Ruth. She's going back to a house full of bread. Is she really empty? But you see how her circumstances are screaming a totally different story for her. She can't see what's right in front of her. Why call me pleasant? Why call me Naomi when the Lord has caused me to suffer and the Almighty has sent such tragedy on me? Again, her perspective. God did this to me, and now I am empty and bitter. She's going to be full, though. Just like Bethlehem, the house of bread is about to be filled, right? She is about to be filled again, and God has already begun that process. He's provided for her food. He's provided for her a companion who's 100% committed to her. Verse 22, so Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by her daughter-in-law Ruth, the young Moabite woman. And they arrived in Bethlehem in late spring at the beginning of the barley harvest. So here Ruth is, or Naomi is, returning with her daughter-in-law Ruth and ending up in the house of bread right as the barley is being raked in. Isn't that great? It's interesting because the author here continues to stress about Ruth. She's a Moabite. She's a Moabite. She's a Moabite. And what you should hear is she doesn't belong here. She really doesn't fit the story very well. She's not Jewish. She's a Moabite. She's a foreigner. But interestingly, in all of this, there's this amazing irony that's going on behind the scenes. If you remember what we shared last week about where the Moabites came from, let's just review the story if you weren't here or if you forgot. But the Moabites came about because God was going to bring destruction on Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay? In Genesis, I believe it's 19, but don't quote me on that. God's going to bring destruction on Sodom and Gomorrah. There is a Jewish man living in that area, and his name was Lot. And God sent an angel to Sodom and Gomorrah to get Lot out. And the instructions that God gave to Lot and his family was, don't turn around and look. When I bring this destruction, don't even turn around and look at the city. Well, Lot's wife turns around and looks, and then she becomes a pillar of salt, right? So then they're fleeing from this destruction. It's Lot and his two daughters. And his two daughters, all they saw was destruction everywhere, and their perspective was, there are no more men left. Maybe some of you women today, single women, are feeling that way. There are no real men left in the world. Well, that's how they felt. And so they came up with a plan. They got their dad drunk, and then they became pregnant through their dad. And the Ammonites and the Moabites were the descendants from those two children. So you have a situation where you have a woman who's childless, comes up with man's plan and creates the enemies of the Jews down the road. And here down the road, you have a Jewish woman who now is childless because her two sons have been killed. And she's hanging out with a Moabite of all people. Right? How God brings this whole story back full circle is just so amazing to me. This is a people group which began because of childlessness, just like Ruth was in that moment. And Naomi thought she was empty. She thought she had nothing. But God had been putting things into her life. Two key things that we read about just right here in chapter 1. Barley and Ruth. Barley and Ruth. Naomi was not truly empty because God was filling her up. So my question for you to ponder this morning is, what kind of things has God been filling up your life right now that you maybe aren't seeing? And I thought maybe as an act of worship this morning, as we wrap up the service, is that we would spend some time just between us and the Lord and making a list of those things that we're thankful for. Yeah, it's Thanksgiving, but it's more than just that. This is an act of worship to God. It's asking Him, as we start this process right now, asking Him, show me what's right in front of me that I haven't been seeing. Because for Naomi, all she saw was all the things in her life that had been taken from her. And what she couldn't see was all the things that God had given her right in front of her face. But her pain and her suffering had blinded her from those things. So as we start this time, the band's going to come up and they're just going to play some instrumental music while we spend some time with the Lord and just make a list. That's the first thing on that sheet that you were given this morning. Just make a list of the things that you could give thanks for, that God would open your eyes to see what those things are. And then the second part of this worship this morning is that you would make a commitment to taking a step to being more like Ruth this morning. You know, throughout life, we can get wounded by other people. And then our strategy that we can develop, sometimes intentionally and sometimes unintentionally, we develop a strategy for dealing with people that goes something like this. I will never, ever let anyone close to me again. And you keep everybody at a distance. And in our culture, this is chronic. It's chronic. We are born with a deep yearning to be loved and a deep yearning to have others that we can love. We all have it. But what happens is the wounds that we get from people can make us agree to never want to engage others again. And that's a terrible strategy. And Ruth provides us a pathway and an example of someone who makes a commitment when she really had no reason to do it other than she wanted to pursue the Lord. And by doing that, she wanted to pursue those around her, her mother-in-law in this case. You know, we're born with this desire for relationship. And for many people, their experience in relationships, particularly spiritual friendships. And what I mean by that is relationships where you're both on the same page in a relationship with God and you're encouraging one another to grow in that relationship. For many, many people, they don't have that in their life. But one of the greatest blessings that Naomi had was Ruth to be that for her. So this morning, what I'm asking us to do is to consider what's been our strategy when it comes to relationships and loss and pain, and make a commitment to take steps to be more like Ruth, to be willing to take a risk and to open up your life to the people that God has placed right in front of you that he wants you to love and demonstrate a commitment to. That we would go beyond just showing up in church and then walking out the door without even having a casual relationship with the people around us. It's not okay. It's not okay. What God calls us to is deeper relationships that require risk and commitment. No matter what they do, no matter what they say, your commitment won't change. You're going to love them through Christ. So spend a few minutes between you and the Lord writing out your response to him in those two areas while the band plays, and then they'll close us out with a song.